nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Today, I'm going to talk about assessing efficacy for various nanomedical therapies. Now, we had a lecture earlier on toxicity, nanotoxicity, and that is more confined with sort of the unintended consequences of treating with our systems. So today what I really want to do is talk about how do you assess if your nanomedical system is actually doing what you want it to do and in fact having a hopefully a positive effect, therapeutic effect on the cells that it's treating. And that's not an easy thing to do. So we're going to talk about that in a variety of ways. Efficacy is going to be broadly defined as anything that is helpful or is basically providing a positive therapeutic effect. And that can be done in a lot of different ways, and I'll go through a number of those things. And we'll talk about the all the way from very simple measures of therapeutic effect down to some molecular ones which you probably haven't thought of. And so I want to introduce some of those concepts to you today. And we'll build on some of the earlier lectures that we had in terms of how we would actually measure those. So the two areas that I'm going to talk about in particular today in terms of assessing those are a concept of looking for a measure of functionality as well as just structure. We've talked about using antibodies where they recognize structures. If we believe that there is a relationship between structure and function, then we can start assessing function. And there's a very particular way with what we call phospho-specific antibodies that I'm going to spend a fair bit of time on today, because when proteins undergo phosphorylation, they go from being sort of from an inactive state to an active state. So we can kind of figure out which proteins are turned on or off. And it's like the switches, the gene switches are turning on in the cell. And so that's a pretty remarkable and very powerful, and something that's, not being done, as far as I know, by, many people, if anyone, here at Purdue. Most proteomics is being done on serums and serum proteins and, but not at the cellular level and not at the level of actually looking, at the proteomics of a single cell. So I'm going to show you some methods today. We can do that. The other thing that I'm going to do is talk a little bit about when we're assessing what happens to a cell, and some we may want to actually look at what's happening to the gene expression profile on a global basis. In other words, what's happening to 20 or 30,000 different genes, and are different gene clusters being turned on such that we know that we're having an effect that is a directed effect due to our therapy. And there are a lot of issues there in terms of how we can measure global gene expression with gene arrays and how many cells you need and just how do you do that anyway. So I'm going to show you some results of things that we've done and suggest what both the possibilities and the limitations are on that. So I'm going to go ahead and get into the lecture here. So first of all, let's talk about for evaluation purposes. What does a structure size measurement reveal? And I'm going to give you an example in the next slide on that. And I'm going to suggest that in general, we've been learning a lot of techniques about single cell evaluations because nanomedicine is single cell oriented. So we have to assess things one cell at a time. And I'm going to review that. We've talked about that earlier in a lecture, about the advantages of single cell approaches to bulk approaches and what you can see, in at the single cell level that you would never see, using bulk cell routines. And then The difficulty of coming up with any kind of functional assays. Functional assays are very difficult to do. Most of them require typically a lot of cells. Dealing with cells, living cells that are changing very rapidly. Having any concept of a group of cells that are really the same is a difficult thing. We call them the same, but in fact, probably no two cells, even in a tissue culture plate, are actually the same. So we have to think about that, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about this phosphorylation functional protein concept that we can measure by flow or image cytometry, and then show some correlations there for functional assays. Well, first of all, we know that we can, because we have diagnostic capabilities typically with our nanomedical systems, we have core materials, nanomaterials that are contrast agents, either X-ray, MRI, or they may have radioactive precursor nucleotides and be PET probes. But in all of that, what we're typically doing is we're diagnostically, we're looking at the size of things. And typically, if you're treating cancer, you might want to, over a period of time, either typically hours or days, you would want to look at the shrinkage of a tumor. And you might be able to do that by non-invasive imaging in a live animal or in a person. And so what I wanted to do is just, if you haven't thought about this, it's a little bit of an unusual way of thinking about it. If you have a tumor of volume V, and you have another tumor of volume 2V, so let's say, so this one has twice the volume that this one does. And let's say this is the starting case before we shrink. You can think of either growing from V to 2V or shrinking from 2V down to V. If you start saying, well, how do I actually measure something like that? If I have a volume-sensitive measurement, then I can actually see something on the order of a factor of 2 difference. And with many measurements, even seeing a factor of 2 differences can be challenging. But if I'm actually looking at this thing projected and I actually look at the diameter of a tumor, and pathologists will do that. They will measure the diameter and in fact, if it's irregularly shaped, they'll even look at it in multiple dimensions. But they'll look at it, in one dimension. And what I would argue is that that's a very tough way to try to get any useful information, because if you, in fact, measure the diameter of this tumor of volume V and the diameter of this tumor of volume 2V, the diameter of this 2V volume tumor is only 1.26 times that. Where did I get 1.26? That's the cube root of 2. All right? And if you're measuring things by surface area, which is another thing, depending on how you're making the measurement, it's only marginally better. Okay? If we actually have something of twice the volume, it will have about 1.59, meaning it's actually the cube root of 2 squared, okay? Or 1.26 squared. So the surface area is proportional to diameter squared. So these differences, and I've actually measured these things on cells around the cell cycle, using time of flight techniques. So measuring very small things. You can do that, but then the variations in these things are pretty small. So when you start thinking about this, what is going to be the relative sensitivity that I'm going to be able to measure if I'm actually watching the shrinkage? If I kill half the cells, will I even see a difference? Will I have the measurement sensitivity to even see that? And the answer is, depending on which of these kinds of measurements that you do, you may or may not. If you're taking a simple X-ray, sort of a shadow in a cross section, this is about the best you're going to do as a cross section. If you're measuring just straight by diameters, this is the best you'll do. So volume sensitive measurements, you might have something, for example, the total contrast signal of an MRI signal is going to be proportional to the tumors that are in it. The problem is all of these things, you know, I've made all these assumptions based on assuming this is a sphere. Obviously things are not going to be perfectly spherical. But here's the most important one. When you actually look at a tumor, many of the cells that are, quote, part of the tumor really aren't tumor cells. And if you talk to a pathologist will always actually take what they call a margin around the tumor, meaning I can't really see how far away from, you know, where the obvious tumor is to where I know it's not a tumor. So I take a pretty liberal circle around that, which may be a rather small tumor, and that tumor margin. And when you start doing that, then typically 80 or 90% of everything that a pathologist would take out might not be tumor at all. A lot of it may be normal tissue. Certainly may be normal at the morphological level. Now, as you start getting into molecular level, gene rearrangements, things like that, you will frequently also see, which is kind of a disturbing result for most pathologists, is that sometimes what looks like perfectly normal tissue around a tumor has already been transformed at the molecular level. And that's a surprising thing if you're used to identifying things on the basis of morphology. Morphology is a very late stage thing. And tissue can look very normal and already be cancerous. So this is a very tough way to try to see things by size and shrinkage. Obviously people do. And that's why we diagnostically can get some information from non-invasive imaging. But what we want to do, particularly when we're evaluating our systems, we want to look at this a little bit more at single cell level. We can do that in two ways. If we can dissociate the single cells, and we've talked about that earlier, we can do flow cytometry. And that's a powerful, and I'm going to show you some flow results. If you can't do that, then you have to start doing imaging technology in either two or three dimensions, and things can get complicated very fast. And the toughest thing about doing single cell analysis on an imaging system is that you're taking slices of tissue and you're actually seeing different planes, because all the cells are not in the same plane. So you may be seeing part of a cell. This is always a problem when you're looking at sections of tissue. So it's a tough thing to do. And if you're trying to leave a thick section, then you've got to be able to adjust up and down the depth as you try to traverse through a tissue. And then as you're doing that sort of auto-focusing and doing in three dimensions, that's a huge amount of data, and it's very hard to scan a very large region. So then you're caught that you really can't take a very large volume of things to look at. So what I'm going to talk about here is quantitative single cell measurements, and we'll start out by assuming that we can do some things by flow cytometry. And we've earlier gone through all of the cluster designations for differentiation antigens for different cell types and how we actually use that in cancer disease staging to actually show what type of leukemia or lymphoma, and those divide into more than 100 different varieties based on the presentation of certain differentiation antigens on the surface. And so that can happen at the surface on live single cells, but in fact, many of the, as I've argued throughout this course, people are obsessed with going after biomarkers that are expressed on the cell surface. And that's a very tough thing to expect, because only a fraction of the genome, maybe only on the order of 10% of the genome, is actually expressed on the surface. The other 90% is inside. So the real question is, and what I'm going to make the argument today, is in many cases you want to be looking inside the cell. And so we're going to talk about some ways, some rather powerful techniques that you can look inside the cell and actually walk your way down signal transduction pathways, and even multiple ones simultaneously, and look at the relationship, see if pathways are actually connected to each other in terms of relative expression levels. So we're going to do that in terms of doing sort of high throughput screening of this, and we'll measure that. Now, typically, we will have to actually chemically fix with a fixative to be able to get inside the cell and stabilize the proteins. But the amazing thing is that it actually works pretty well. And in fact, these phospho-specific antibodies, where we actually go in with an antibody that recognizes the phosphorylated regions of a protein that are turned on when the protein goes from an inactive state to an active state, that we can actually have an antibody that will distinguish between the active form of the protein versus the inactive form. And that's very powerful because most of what the cells do in terms of function is expressed through their proteins. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then lastly, and this is really important since we are talking about proteins, and this, as you know, the human genome is surprisingly small. Okay, it's embarrassingly small. There are many creatures with much larger genomes than ours. But the way that humans use their genomes is that they use the same proteins for more than one function. And the same protein can have very different functions when it's in different locations inside a cell. So there is a whole field, and I know some of you are working in proteomics, that you probably haven't heard of, because it's a relatively small number of people working in this area, called locational proteomics, where they actually use three-dimensional, typically confocal microscopy and high-resolution confocal microscopy, to actually map the locations three-dimensionally and do proteomics at single-cell level. So we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go through the lecture today. Now, first I want to remind you, we talked about this back in lecture 4, and if you remember, that's also the lecture that we talked about antibodies and labeling techniques. And so when we talked about being able to label some molecular property, now typically today we're going to talk about using antibodies, phospho-specific antibodies. If we have our flow cytometric distribution, number of cells, and we measure a property, this is not an error, if you remember, around some actual value. The error bars are so small on this curve that, in fact, you couldn't even put the error bars on there. We can see 1% differences in molecular properties that we measure. Now, if we looked at this, we'd say, oh, gee, there's one distribution and some kind of variation around some central thing if we looked at this distribution. If we took just a bulk measurement, like the equivalent of doing a Western blot, measuring the amount of protein in a band, then we could not tell the difference between something that was expressed like this and something that had two totally different entities here. You know, and again, they may be totally different but come out in the same actual band on a Western blot. But I'm just trying to take it. If you take a bulk measurement, you could not tell the difference. But individually, you'd say, oh, I have two populations, an A population and a B population. Now, that looks pretty good, but as we said, the power of doing something by cytometry, single-cell measurements, is we can keep measuring more and more measurements. We can measure, people have measured up to 17 colors of fluorescence simultaneously. And so a simple one is just if you start correlating these, and you say, I'll take molecular property 2, and I'll plot that versus molecular property 1. And so every one of these points is an XY pair of data points where I have each of these points has a certain amount of molecular property 1 and a certain amount of molecular property 2. But then when I look at them like that in two dimensions, then I start saying, well, I don't have 2. See, if I looked at this projected down onto molecular property 1, it would actually, the projected down version would look just like this. And I'd say there's only one population. And the projected down distribution looks like 2 of these. If I look at along here, A and C are on top of each other, B and D are on top of each other. So there's really 2 populations in here and really 2 populations in here. So things start to get more complicated. And what I tell people is, well, guess what? And when you start adding a third and a fourth parameter, then these may start subdividing into more possibilities. So things can get very complicated, but you can also get very, very sophisticated. And the beauty is that we can measure all of these properties at single cell and the correlation of those properties is something that's very powerful, because that is telling you a lot about how the genes are regulated or dysregulated with regard to each other. And during disease, what we see are typically dysregulations of the gene patterns. So this is one way to measure that. If we were measuring this, for example, with proteins and measuring antibodies, we would actually be able to look at the changes in expression of certain proteins as the cells, perhaps the cells became diseased. Okay, so what we think about is when we deal with something like a shape recognition with an antibody that's recognizing an epitope. And we've talked about that earlier. We can get exquisitely sensitive. Even on the same protein, we will have multiple epitopes so that we can label with each monoclonal antibody will be specific for a very particular epitope. And so we're used to looking at this in terms of structure. And the thing that I'm adding today, which you may or may not be familiar with, is the concept that when you activate a protein, you phosphorylate it, you actually change its shape. And you change its shape in a way that it has different epitopes, or its epitope shapes change. So you can actually design an antibody that recognizes that shape change. Now, luckily for you, the part of this that's important is you don't have to go make your own. There are hundreds of phospho-specific antibodies commercially available. And this is, you know, this is a well-established art. It's been around, the earliest work is, has only been around since about 2004. But this is a very rapid and powerful technique that you can use. So I'm going to take you through an example of some, we're changing from structural things to actually measuring something as saying, I can measure a functional difference between an active form of a protein versus its inactive form. I can also do similar types of things, actually measuring things like gene silencing, which also those same kinds of things can happen. And I can use phospho-specific flow cytometry for measuring gene silencing. So very, very powerful technique. So let's take you through an example of this. This is an example, probably one of the best groups in the world. This is from Gary Nolan's lab at Stanford University. And the first papers were really published around 2004. And that's become before there were anything commercially available. Now there's a lot of them. So let's go very rapidly through what some of the advantages are. So first of all, as I mentioned, phosphorylated proteins can be distinguished from their non-phosphorylated forms, okay, by antibodies. So we can see how much relative in a given cell of the protein has been phosphorylated. We can measure it quantitatively with very high accuracy. Since these are inside cells, we have to develop a technique to fix those. But the interesting thing is that that people spent many years trying to measure proteins inside cells, and it was excruciating work. But as in science, we stand on the shoulders of those that suffered, the many graduate students and other people who worked out the techniques, so that we know how to fix cells well enough. And the phosphorylated forms seem to be not as sensitive as we would have thought them to be. So this works out surprisingly well. And in particular, so we have to prefix the cells to make enough so that the antibodies can get inside, because antibodies will not go through a normal cell membrane intact. And the important thing is some of these phosphorylated proteins can be parts of various signal transduction pathways. So as you know, the cell consists of a network of pathways, transduction pathways and other things, and they talk to each other in networks. So what we can do is actually walk our way down. We have phosphorylated forms of many of the proteins that actually go down a particular pathway, and you can actually watch the relative where the cell is in terms of how much of that pathway it's using. And is it starting to activate another pathway? And all you have to do is use phospho-specific antibodies with a different color fluorochrome on there. So you can actually add phospho-specific antibodies of different colors. And again, you could theoretically take that out to 10 or 15 different ones simultaneously. So this is the power of that, that you can actually not only look at one pathway at a time. People used to spend their entire career, believe it or not, on one protein. And then they graduated to one pathway. Okay, and now we tend to do things, lots of measurements, and the power is in taking lots of measurements and relating them to each other. Because it doesn't do you very much good to measure one protein when, and people used to literally measure one protein not even knowing where it was in the cell. So you can imagine the kind of equivocal results that people got, because it may have, the protein may have been in the nucleus, it may have been in the cytoplasm, totally different functions, and yet they were, because they were extracting the proteins out of the cells, they had no idea where the location was. So here, what we can do is we can measure them. Now, in flow cytometry, they're going to be measured only where they are inside a cell, although we actually can do a little bit of locational to the point of, for example, saying, is it in the nucleus or is it in the cytoplasm? We can actually distinguish those kinds of measurements using time-of-flight techniques in flow cytometry. But there are many, many, literally hundreds of them now, commercially available phosphospecific antibodies. So in most cases, you don't have to make your own, and people have made ones to all of the common and most important ones that you're likely to want to look at. So let's look at this. If we actually did, compared a Western blot, which is a bulk cell analysis, meaning we just look at multiple cells, and you saw from the previous slide, all you're going to do is average in all of those things. And worse yet, remembering that that tumor that we may have looked at may have had 20% of real tumor cells in it and 80% of normal cells. And you're going to mix those two together and try to make one abstract property. That would be not a very intelligent thing to do. So what we want to do is we want to look one at a time, and we want to distinguish what type of cell it is. So we need to look. In some cases, we can use another. We might have a biomarker that's expressed, and then look at the phospho-specific antibodies on the cells which are expressing the tumor marker versus that are not expressing the tumor marker. And we can do all of the logic gating of that data here, doing multiple parameters. You typically need a very large number of cells to make a lot of these bulk cell measurements. And the interesting thing is you start thinking of how much material is actually present in a cell when you make a measurement by flow cytometry, you're getting down to femtomolar quantities. It's incredible how small a detection. And depending on if we have an appropriate amplification technique, people are actually going down to effectively on the order of 100 molecules or fewer in a cell that you can measure, and do that at very high speeds. And again, the other thing that you might want to do is you might want to take those cells out, and here again, they're all mixed together, but anything that we can measure, we can also separate. So you have the possibility of separating out cells which are functionally, they may look exactly the same, but they're functionally different on the basis of the phospho-specific antibodies, and then you can do a biochemical, if you can sort enough cells, you can do a biochemical study using other probes offline. That's a little bit hard unless you have a technique that doesn't require a huge number of cells to do that. Okay, so here's an example right from that same paper, from Gary Nolan's paper, showing that why it's superior. And in this particular one, they're showing, basically going through the same arguments that I just went through in an earlier slide, about the flow cytometry distributions and whether you have more than one population. And if you start having a very small population that may be hidden by a large one, and quite often, as you're measuring rare tumor cells, you may have one of these cells here as a disease cell or tumor cell, versus 100,000 or a million of those. So it's going to get lost in the noise if you're trying to actually put all of these together and try to abstract a property. So again, in that paper, you can go through in details, but he's basically showing you what it looks like if you have a very rare cell in a mixture, and what's going to happen with the Western blot. You're going to miss everything that's there, and you can't tell whether there is different amounts of it there. And if you look at if you induce the phosphorylation here, you can see with a particular stimulus that you're actually changing the amount of phosphorylation on different proteins, and you can do more than one color and look at the relative amounts shifting of that between them. And when you do that, these events that you're seeing here shown at the molecular stage, if you actually then analyze those, remember, you can analyze those maybe at 100,000 cells a minute that you can actually make measurements at. So you can make a lot of measurements. And when you actually take this data showing these, for example, these red cells versus the green cells that are phosphorylated or not, then you can see very quickly that I can do a plot of red fluorescence versus green and divide myself up into not only the red only case here that's phosphorylated, or the green only case that's phosphorylated here, but in some cases I may be simultaneously turning on two different transduction networks, in which case I would show that I have both the red and the green simultaneously, so a double labeled cell here. So we can very quickly pull out those two different cases. And we can also take that with regard to other properties, because we can physically look at differences of cell properties based on size and external structure. For example, with forward scatter versus side scatter. We can also use other things. And this particular one is a T cell receptor, expressed or not expressed, to be able to pull out T cells from B cells, for example. And then we can study what's happening individually inside the B cells, as opposed to the T cells, in terms of various phosphorylated structures, proteins within those structures, and divide it up by cell types. So we can have multiple cell types and then actually look at particular protein expressions, whether they're phosphorylated or not, in those subpopulations. We can also make measurements of multiple kinases, and that's we can do that simultaneously here. And we can start, you know, when this data gets very, very complicated, as you start making multiple measurements, what people have done is they've actually made similar to heat maps that people use on microarray data. So you start making protein expression heat maps based on all of this very, very complicated data. As I said, you could do maybe 10 or 15 of these at a time and actually look at those and effectively produce a heat map of the different cell types under the different conditions. So you get a very powerful analysis there. And again, this is by the group that really initiated a lot of this at Stanford and has done some of the most sophisticated work. So what are some of the clinical applications that you can actually see that this actually pertains to human disease? You certainly can look at immune cell development and various immune cell problems. You can actually profile different diseases, and there's a lot of work going on with profiling various T cells and populations in there. We can look at lymphocyte populations in leukemias, lymphomas, and very quickly discover whether those are highly activated or not. We can get very rare cell populations, for example, dendritic cells, or stem cells that you'd never see by biochemical techniques. And then what I think is really powerful here is you're starting to dissect all of the complex interactions between networks in a cell. To me, a cell is like a universe. It's a very big thing, where we have, you know, maybe 30,000 genes being expressed in complex relationships to each other. And we need to start being able to analyze that. And people are actually taking this kind of data with the phospho-specific antibodies, and they're basically designing sort of in silico. You've heard that expression, in silico biology, where you're actually starting to construct a theoretical cell with all kinds of networks behaving certain ways, and then they're actually starting to develop these for drug discovery and for predicting what the cell responses will be to various new drugs that are being developed, so that you can actually develop a computer model So this is still at early stages, but people are actually trying to make effectively an electronic cell where they actually understand as many of the networks and what their relationships are to each other. And the way that they actually get some data and is by some of these phospho-specific antibody methods. Continuing on, you can do obviously a lot of pharmacodynamic monitoring and drug screening and high throughput methods, because you can do this not only by flow cytometry but also scanning across tissues of different types. And we've talked about that, why it's important to take cell types and maybe human cell types like myocardial cells, neural cells, in addition to things like liver cells, so that you know what's actually happening and being activated in different types of cells. We can look at multiple intracellular pathways simultaneously to see if we're activating other complexes and starting the generation of complex intermediates during drug effects on those cells. And we can gradually develop, and people are working very hard on this, is to actually come up with a complex pattern of phospho-specific antibodies to actually define a disease state and a progression level. So right now, a lot of pathology is done just by simple staging, like stage one, where something is local, stage two, where it's starting to invade the neighboring tissue, stage three, where it's basically invaded the tissue, and stage four, when it's basically gone to a lot of other places. But those are pretty crude estimates by location. And what you'd really like to be able to do is to come up with something where you could predict, are those cells that are in stage one going to stay in stage one? Or do you have metastatic cells? And then what we'd really like to be able to do is to be able to come up with a phenotype at the molecular level to say, this cell, as opposed to its neighbor, the neighbor is likely to stay here, but this cell is getting ready to metastasize. And then we would want to be able to know that and be able to keep it non-metastatic. And as I've mentioned to you earlier, that's one of the most important things we can do, particularly for cancer treatment, is to distinguish. Not all cancer cells are the same. Some of them are going to be, as you say, you're going to die of something else many years hence, rather than die of that cancer cell. But you need to be able to know which ones are likely to do different things. And again, we've talked earlier on the rare cell targeting, where the probability of a cancer cell actually metastasizing to a different, distant part of the body and actually surviving there, the odds are usually given somewhere between 1 in 100,000 and 1 in 1,000,000. So it's pretty rare. And so how do you do that? Right now we have no way of predicting that. But the idea is, through these methods, can we come up with a system where we can predict that certain types of cells are more likely to survive? Okay? So that's one of the things that we hope to do, is to do a phospho-epitope analysis, to actually see which genes are effectively turned on and which are turned off in each of those cells. Okay, well, let's talk another thing. We can talk about single-cell gene silencing, because one of the things that people are also trying to do therapeutically with nanomedical approaches is to introduce gene silencing probes into cells. And I mentioned to you, with the phospho-specific antibodies, we can't get antibodies into cells, but the neat thing is that we can actually, as you know, we can traffic using nanoparticle and receptor-mediated uptake approaches. We can actually carry things from the outside through the membrane into a living cell, and then actually try to depress the production of certain proteins at the gene level with gene silencing probes. And if we can do that, we can do that with living cells, and we can actually treat that as a way to actually mildly reprogram the cell. As I mentioned to you, it'd be nice in nanomedicine to do something besides killing cells. I would hope that after all this work that people are doing, that we would come up with an approach which would do something other than being another way of killing a cell. So in many cases, we want to reprogram the cells. We want to keep the organ functioning because we don't want the treatment to be causing a failure of the organ. In many cases, the disease can cause the failure of the organ, but so can the treatment. So we definitely don't want to make it worse. So if we can reprogram the cell, and one way that people are trying to do this, and I've given you Shirley Chan's group, an example of doing this again and being able to measure it. So here what we have is an siRNA-mediated protein knockdown that we can actually measure the relative expression levels of this and actually say, have we been able to affect the protein levels and knock them down? We can measure those at single cell level. We can say which cells have we knocked down, which have we not knocked down. And you may find that there are cells which are maybe cell cycle dependent, so that you would have to perhaps do multiple treatments as the cell goes from one cell cycle stage to another. And this shows you some examples of what happens if you actually start looking at protein knockdowns and looking at differences with Western blots and actually then starting to look at these cells at the single cell level. So here we're showing pictures of those, but we can make all of these measurements by flow cytometry. And we can actually look at the knockdown of a very specific proteins in living cells by the knockdown techniques. And we can do that over time. That's also, as I mentioned to you, sometimes it's important if this particular one is using transfected siRNA, transfected Jurkat cells, and we can actually measure the percent of cells. There's two things we can do with flow cytometry rapidly. We can get the percentage of cells that are affected, and then we can also look at the protein levels, the actually quantitative protein levels cell by cell. So those are always two separate things, and you want to keep that in mind because sometimes one of those may stay the same. In other words, the quantitation may stay the same, but the number that are expressing that may drop. In other words, maybe a percentage of that. Or you may have all of the cells may have do you have 50% of the cells responding 100%? Or do you have 100% of the cells responding by depressing 50%? And if you're measuring that by bulk properties, you can't tell the difference. But it's a very important difference. So we can do that looking quantitatively by the percentage of the cells and also at the actual level of expression. Now, the one danger of this is remembering always that, and it's not just a fault of flow cytometry or image cytometry, but you only measure the survivors. So if something disappears, then, and you don't see it, you can't measure it. And this happens a lot during a lot of these treatments. So it's a good idea to keep track of the number of cells that are actually there, and saying, when I look at the percentage going down, is also the absolute number going down? If I'm only looking at 20% of the cells surviving, then is that 20% in any way representative of what happened to the other 80%? That's a gotcha that we have in science, is that we can only measure what we can measure. If it's gone, then we don't know what happened to it. And we can try to think that the sample that we sampled is similar to the sample that we didn't sample, but we don't know that. So that's something that you have to pay attention to when you're doing these kinds of experiments. And so you can simultaneously do not only siRNA mediated protein knockdown, but you can also measure the stimulation into different cell subsets using a different marker. So you can do multiple experiments simultaneously on the same cells and actually divide them by type, by whether they've been stimulated into a particular state and also by their siRNA knockdown. So here, we also have the idea that you can come along and stimulate cells with, for example, with, in this particular case, an antibody, anti-CD3. CD3 is a, we call it a pan, T cell, marker antibody. So we're going to be interacting with the T cell receptor on the surface of those cells. And that acts things quite often, as we talked about earlier, when you interact things with molecules on the surface, those molecules are connected and there are signal transduction pathways that connect them throughout the cell. So think of it as it's the equivalent of tickling the cell. At one part, the entire cell feels the tickle that from the outside of the, in this particular case of the antibody, binding to a receptor on the surface. So you can actually use that, the interaction on the surface to, in this case, to stimulate and then look at the phosphorylation states. What have you done when you've touched that cell with your binding event? You've actually caused it to change. And that's something, you know, sort of our Heisenberg uncertainty principle in biology, that when we interact with things and even have our nanomedical systems interact with the surface, that interaction event, when it binds to a receptor on the surface, may actually cause signal transduction effects throughout the cell. So we have to know that, because we may or may not want to cause that interaction. So there are ways. So what I'm saying is here is we can actually measure and say, when we bind that, did we turn on a particular pathway or did we leave it alone? In some cases, you want to do either turn it on or you want to leave it alone. And so you can go back through there and you can do quite a bit of data here, data analysis, looking at not only your phosphorylation events, you can look at your mean fluorescence intensity and look at that and see that your stimulated, for example, your CD3 stimulated, even though it has the LCK status is very low, its mean fluorescent intensity is the same as in the unstimulated, which is considered a very high level of LCK expression. So we can look at, again, with using multi-parameter analysis, we can look at multiple properties. We can gate behind the scenes in this idea of looking at things where the antibody has, against, CD3 on the surface, has bound to it. We can separate that population from the one where it's not bound to the surface. We can also combine that with other antibodies and look at different cell subsets. So this is a CD3 positive CD8 subset here, that a subset of the T cells that are behaving differently. So we can do that and walk our way down into not only whether the different types of cells and whether they're activated or not. So we can do a very complex analysis of this. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk now about, it's nice to say that we can look at signal transduction pathways with the phospho-specific antibodies, but one of the things that my group was very interested in a number of years ago was to say, can I look at global gene expression? What have I done to all of the genes, every single gene that's in the cell? Do I know whether I've actually affected it or left it alone? And so how do we look at that? Is it possible to look at gene expression at the single cell level? And I'm going to show you some data both ways about what it is. And if it's not possible, how similar do cells have to be? You know, you look at cells and you say, oh, those cells are the same. But I'm going to make the argument that no two cells are probably ever exactly the same. If you think of 30,000 genes being expressed, there are probably no two cells exactly the same, okay? And so to group them together is a very dangerous thing. We have to do it for many of the measurements that we make. And so we typically purify cell populations out on the basis of some property that we think makes them similar. And the question is, how good does a purified population have to be before you get out of the that the problem that I talked about where you have mixtures of cells and you have two or more populations. So at what point have you purified it enough that you can get effectively a bulk cell measurement of the purified population that's meaningful? So what I'm going to do, we actually were among the first groups to actually do this, and it was kind of interesting because when people started getting back to this problem about pathologists taking out tumors and having the cells, a lot of them being normal as well as tumor, people did gene arrays on those and the data was just awful. And so some of the best data in the world, early data, came out of MD Anderson Cancer Center. And that data consisted of where people had, we call monoclonal tumors, where you had a very homogeneous mass of tumors. And we say that they actually separated out the cells the old-fashioned way with a knife. And they actually were able to get those out and put them on a gene array and actually show a difference between the normal cells and the tumor cells. Whereas a lot of people, when you had diffuse, not well-defined tumors, and they did maybe very large margins because they couldn't see where the tumor was, then they weren't seeing almost no differences on the gene expression profiles, microarrays, so RNA microarrays. So we started saying, well, that's nice. We're not going to carve out ones from a patient's tumor, but what we can do is separate them one cell at a time very, very fast using a cell sorter. In fact, a high-speed cell sorter to actually get enough material and actually look at what kind of purity do we actually need. In other words, with the flow cytometer, we're doing the same thing that they were doing, the surgeons were doing with a very, very homogeneous tumor, and try to get as few non-tumor cells in there so that when you deliver it to the array that you could actually measure it. So this is the work of Peter Sonnenslow, who we published a paper together in 2004. He finished his thesis in 2007, actually after I moved here. We basically said, how pure a population do you have to have in a microarray before you get any kind of meaningful results at all? And that wasn't really known. So what we had was mixtures of cells. We had actually cord blood. We were actually looking at this as a problem with regard to stem cells, and in some cases cancer stem cells. And we actually were doping in cells of different type into blood. We had cord blood plus some CD34 positive stem cells. We had a KG1 human stem cell line that we're growing that was CD34 positive, but as we showed very quickly, those CD34 human stem cell line, everybody was saying, oh, this is a good cell to use to study this, study stem cells, because it had CD34 on it. What they didn't look was all the other genes. And it turns out all the other genes were quite different, as seen from here, where we had, for example, in this column right here, you see these should all theoretically be the same on a heat map of the genes, and you can see very quickly that while there are some similarities, there are a lot of differences here between these cell types. Regular cord cells and true stem cells, a human stem cell line, and then when you start putting these things into a mixture and doing magnetic separation. So we actually did the arrays and started looking at the correlations between these, and you could very quickly prove that the cells were quite different. So when we were doing this with Affymetrix gene arrays, which was sort of the state of the art at that point in time, also compared that with various types of probes, with robotic spotters and photolithography fabrications here, and also, in general, we were looking at virtually all of the known human genes at the time. And looking at the number of features per array. So when you're looking at 38,000 genes on these arrays, if you actually look at it almost like pixel elements on an image, there were roughly 1 million pixels that we actually measured pixel by pixel. and actually did a lot of that work. So you start asking yourself, well, how much material does it take to put on these arrays? So typically, these Affymetrix arrays would take 5 to 25 micrograms of total RNA, of which only a fraction of that is the messenger RNA that's being produced when you're actually producing a protein. When you've turned on the gene and you produce a messenger RNA to actually go build that protein, then it's only a fraction of this. And then you're doing a hybridization step to the array. So let's look at a few of these arrays and look at, if you start thinking about how much material you need, people came up with various types of doing, either exponential or so-called linear, RNA amplification, saying, can I make more copies? What if I don't have enough cells, to be able to get, a realistic amount of RNA on here? And if I don't have the option that I just simply can't sort more cells, can I actually amplify all of the RNA of an individual cell similar to what that first cell? So can I make one cell worth of RNA here? Can I actually amplify, let's say, each of the RNA sequences that are in there, let's say 100,000 to 1,000,000 fold, to do the equivalent of making them if I had 1,000,000 exactly the same cells? So that's the question. So people were coming up with all kinds of methods for so-called linear RNA amplification. And in fact, they're doing a little better than that now, but I'm going to show you a few results of that we did. So if you actually look at the arrays and you look at the two different cell types, you'll see that some genes are expressed or not expressed. For example, here we're missing one here we're missing one expressed. Each of these pixels is a particular gene sequence that we're measuring. And we can see similarities and differences. So here's an important difference right here, where you have a very high level of expression of this, and it's in a relatively low level in this other cell type. So CEM cells versus A2780s. So the question is then, if you start making mixtures of these two cell types, so you have a pure mixture of CEM cells on this end, you have a pure mixture of A2780s at this, and the overall patterns you can see different at these ends, but at what point do you lose the ability to see? And what you find is that it matters what the relative level is. If you have a very high, extremely high expression level of a particular gene, then you may be able to get by with 75%, on the order of 75% purity. If it's a moderate level gene, you may need over 90% purity. And then if it's a rather low level of expression, then you need to be almost like 99% pure. So it tells you that this is why people didn't see things. They only were seeing, as we say, the tips of the icebergs, because the ocean levels were too high of the total genome expression. So you're only seeing the big ones. And that's why people were saying, oh, I saw, you know, I looked at 30,000 genes and I saw 10 of them different. Okay. And it's because they were seeing the ones which were very highly expressed, as opposed to not much at all. So the purity of the cell sample makes a big difference. And you have to get some idea of what that is and whether it's realistic. And can I get enough cells to be able to see that? So we can look at that and look at the effect of cell mixtures on gene expression. Here's moderately expressed genes in the presence of a very high background, and actually looking at the gene expression levels here. Oh, these are different genes, 5 different genes that are on here. And again, another 5 different genes expressed, and whether you can see the differences or not with low background versus high background. And so lastly, and this should say 10 to the 4th, not 104, and this should say 10 to the 6th cells unamplified. So what we have here is a way of saying, if we have no amplification, if you had 3 million cells, if you're actually able to get 3 billion cells, you don't need to amplify. So this is what the pattern would look like. What if I can only get, in this case, 10,000 cells, and I go through one round of RNA amplification? Does this pattern look like the unamplified one? And if you look at that, you say, well, it looks pretty similar. There's some differences, but it's looking very similar. If I have to go a second round, in other words, amplify the amplified portions of it, then you start seeing more and more differences down this, but this is done with a single cell. So there are going to be some genes. This still looks a lot like this in here, which looks a lot like this in here, whereas we're losing things out in other, looking at other genes. So the answer is, for some genes, if you're lucky enough to have genes expressed at a good level, then you can in fact do a gene array of a single cell. But if they're moderate or lowly expressed, then you're going to start losing some of those characteristics. So linear amplification is highly reproducible, but it reduces the important differences. And there was a funny story with this, which is, I think, a good teachable moment to graduate students. So when you're doing RNA amplification, there are errors in it. So the interesting thing was that we were talking with a group in Houston that would say, well, the more times we do it, the better it gets. And I thought, wait a minute, you have an error-prone process, you do it more and more, and you're getting it better and better? I don't think so. So what we did was we did an experiment with these two totally different cell types, I mean really different cell types, and we amplified them lots of times. And what we found was that we made the gene expression profile for two totally different cell types identical. So if you did it enough times, you would only amplify certain genes and you would get an identical gene expression profile, even though the cells were totally different. So if you make, you gotta ask yourself common sense. If you have an error-prone process and you do it over and over and over again, it isn't gonna get better and better. It's gonna get worse and worse. Okay, but that was kind of a funny result because of thinking that things were getting better and better when they really weren't. Okay, so RNA linear amplification does distort the gene expression profile. We were actually trying to study nonlinear amplifications of gene expression out along multiple pathways, and actually looking at like 30,000 different pathways and seeing that each one of them potentially had a different function. So it was not linear, but the functions were different, and at some level you would lose them, but that you would keep some pattern. We found was that the best we could do was about 80% for some cell types, that we could actually recover the pattern and actually see the cell. So the take-home message from all of this, and I'll just skip ahead to this, you can't amplify genes if they're absent, so you don't have a problem of generating false positive noise, but you lose ones that are below a certain level. And at that, so the strong ones will stay out there strong. The moderates, you may get a little bit variability, but the ones on the low end, they'll drop out and you'll just start missing those. But if you start thinking about, usually if we think that if the cell behavior, let's say the cell is producing a lot of something in a disease or it drops a lot from being in an undiseased state, you're seeing big changes, you should be able to measure those. So what the take-home message with this is that you can do global gene expression as casting out a very wide net of what to look for. And then you can decide to hone in on a few genes that you know are associated with the pathways of interest. But this allows you to look at hundreds of different pathways simultaneously and say, well, 90 of these I don't have to worry about, but these 10 pathways are changing in some fundamental way, so I better watch what's happening when I'm looking at them. So yes, gene expression arrays are useful for looking globally what's happening, but only in a rough way so that you can study them more specifically with things like phospho-specific antibodies. Okay, with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have, and here are some, I'll give you copies of these. I probably won't give you the copy of the entire thesis, but you're welcome to come to me. Most of you probably don't want to read a 200 plus page thesis. You're going to be writing your own, right? Questions? I'm just curious, how many of you knew about phospho-specific antibodies measuring activated versus non-activated forms of proteins? Any of you? This is all new? Okay. Good thing to know. Very, very powerful technique. And you don't have to get necessarily as fancy as we showed here with multiple ones simultaneously in different colors. You can actually study one particular transduction pathway and just look under a microscope and look at it. So it's a very powerful technique, and these antibodies are not that expensive. So they're worth looking at. Yes?
So for the phospho-specific antibodies, to do this test, you said we need just, first of all, to need to prefix.
Yes.
So the prefix process will influence the real biological situation inside the system.
Yeah. So his question is saying, if you're going to use phospho-specific antibodies, you're obviously, the cells are not live. And you have to make the assumption that during the fixation process that, it's going to be hopefully, let's say, fast enough so that the relative quantities of different proteins don't change, and that they get chemically fixed. That's probably less of a problem than if different proteins, when proteins get fixed, chemically fixed, they can be variable in terms of their recognition by antibodies. So each of these ones that you buy, those are the ones that worked. Okay. They figured out a lot of ones that didn't work. That the shape recognition wasn't good enough, so that when you try, so they will tell you with each of these phospho-specific antibodies how to fix the cell, and they basically have done the work. They've gone back between Westerns and the cell types and actually quantified the amount of phosphorylated protein versus non-phosphorylated, and they've shown that in the cell that will work under these fixation protocols. As I said, people spent about over 20 years learning how to try to fix cells so that they could study, use antibodies, and look inside. They've done that work for you, and giving you the phosphorylated antibodies that actually will still work under that fixation protocol. Now, that said, it is possible that you could have every cell type is a little different, and so, they'll tell you what they've tested it on, but it's possible because remember, it's where the proteins are in the cell that can be quite different from cell type to cell type. So you want to keep that in mind, that it may work great on the cell type that they did, but if you have a very different cell type where the protein is maybe harder to access in a different compartment of the cell, think about locational proteomics, then in that case, it may not label as efficiently. And so you got to be a little careful with that. So it's not perfect.
From my previous experience, we usually use some like ethanol or formaldehyde and formalin to just fix the cell. So I'm not sure whether this process will greatly change the specific structure of some phosphorylated proteins.
You will definitely change the structure of proteins with things like ethanol fixation or formalin fix. The question is whether you will change the recognition of the phospho-specific antibody for that epitope. And so, in general, you would not use ethanol for those. There are much better fixatives that do a lot less to protein structures than those. Those are not good. We can talk about that more if you're interested, but people have done a lot of work, and there's some very gentle fixatives that actually don't do a lot of changing a protein structure. They just stabilize it. And there's even what we call reversible cross-linking methods where you can temporarily anchor proteins in a form to keep them together and then basically dissolve that linkage. So but ethanol, you would never use something like ethanol. First of all, ethanol, what it'll do, ethanol extracts lipids. So first thing that happens is that it basically extracts most of the lipid out of the membrane and the cell just really shrinks and goes through a pretty traumatic exercise. So unless you're doing something like DNA measurements, then you would never use something like that. But something like a paraformaldehyde, 1% paraformaldehyde fixation works with at least some of these phospho-specific antibodies. There's a lot of other fixatives out there. But good question, because none of these things are ever perfect. And you've got to always, but on the other hand, given what they do, they're pretty powerful. If you're starting to think about actually measuring something functionally at the gene level, at single cell level, and looking at that's, think of the power of the technique. Other questions? Abby, any perspectives from the point of view of a pathologist? Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So his question is this: going back to this statement that I made about how the tissue around the tumor may appear normal at the morphological level, but may be at the molecular level already changed. And the question is that clinically relevant, or is that just something that's a biological artifact? I think it is clinically relevant. We actually did some of the very early microdissection of tissue around in the margin regions around tumors and looked for c-MYC oncogene levels. And given what was subsequently found out about that, given those levels, those cells were transformed, they were going to become cancerous, and yet at the morphological level, the pathologists, very good pathologists, would say that that was normal tissue. It actually happened by accident. We put those as a normal control and found out it wasn't normal. It was a real surprise to us. So the level of that, I think, it depends on what the molecular transformation has been, as to whether it may be a slow transformation event, or it may be something that's going to make those cells highly malignant. So it's going to vary with the particular thing. But I'm just warning you that things that look normal at the morphological level may or may not be normal at the actual molecular level. And since we're doing nanomedicine, we're doing things at single cell level. We have to start worrying what has happened inside individual cells. But excellent question. Yeah.
For this kind of phospho labeling requires the intact cell membrane. Will those proteins after label they were diffused out of the cell?
Ah, okay. So the question is we have to permeabilize the cell a little bit to get the antibodies in. And the question is, do the proteins that you're looking for leak out? Okay. That's why people spent 20 years playing with various fixatives under various conditions, trying to come up with a way to give enough permeability. If you think about it, that's why you typically want to do some cross-linking, with your fixative, because you're making holes that are big enough. If you're making holes big enough to get an antibody, which is about 200,000 Daltons in, then that means that a protein of 200,000 Daltons can come out, right? If you don't anchor it to something else. So that's why most of the fixatives that people use are in some way cross-linking fixatives that will link it to other structures, so that you're not just let things to be freely diffusing. So the fixatives matter, and that's why you wouldn't use an ethanol. You tear huge holes with ethanol, and you don't make cross links in the same way. You're just extracting lipids. So that would be a very bad fixative to use, and the proteins would leak out really, really readily. But a very, very good question. So you have to make sure your proteins don't leak out. Okay.